The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December is a Christmas book for children ages 5 through 9. It's titled The Christmas Connection. You can find out more about this new Christmas Arch book at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase The Christmas Connection by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Your young children, grandchildren, and godchildren will discover the relationship between Jesus' birth and resurrection in The Christmas Connection. 1-800-325-3040.
Christ's birth, like this tree, is a reminder that God is always with us. We may neglect him, we may reject him, but he never forsakes us.
The New York-based and Washington-based too, probably media powerhouses, don't quite get religion. We don't get the role of religion in people's lives.
The colors of the rainbow went from blue on one edge of the rainbow to red on the other. And they saw in that a reminder that just as God once destroyed the world with water, he will again destroy the world, this time by fire.
Uber drivers around the world love listening to Issues Etc. on demand while we're waiting for a ride request.
We often are a little worried that maybe, just maybe, a lot of the claims that are made about, well, we used to call it an unnatural love. Now it's just called LGBTQ or the gay and lesbian lifestyle. Of course, it can't be limited to that now because the sexual revolution has spread out like so much peanut butter on a piece of bread. The whole notion of sexual orientation and now gender and sex. But we might worry, golly, do those who are advocating for these things, do they have the science on their side? When they say that children raised in a same-sex marriage household are just as well off, maybe even a little better, than children with a mom and a dad, are they right? Do they have the science, be it the hard sciences or social sciences, on their side? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, December the 14th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. It's part three of our series, Are Social Progressives Anti-Science? Today on the subject of homosexuality, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest for the first half hour of the program. Terry Mattingly joins us after that. We're going to talk about the admission by a New York Times executive editor. He said, in effect, no, he actually said word for word, we don't get religion. What did he mean? What was the context of that statement? And what can be done to remedy that problem when the New York Times, the paper of record, says at the highest echelons, we don't get religion and religion is part of so many stories. What can they do to improve that situation? Doug Axe joins us after that. He's a molecular biologist and he's director of the Biologic Institute for the Discovery Institute. We're going to talk about a recent conference in London, a big one, the Royal Academy of Sciences, wherein a major evolutionist said that there are certain explanatory deficits in evolutionary theory as it stands today. Mark Hemingway will join us for the Weekly Standard. We'll talk about two issues, Democratic excuses for Trump's victory and presidential vote recounts. Now, you can join us with questions or comments over the next 2 hours of the program. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us for part three of our series, Are Social Progressives Anti-Science? Today on the subject of homosexuality, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she is author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
You do this a lot. You debate, you lecture on the issue of homosexuality. Have you ever been accused of being anti-science because you're a Christian and you have religious sensibilities on the subject?
Well, actually, that tends not to happen to me too much because I usually start with science. And usually my opponent is the first person to bring up religion. So it hasn't. I've been a little bit insulated from that, as a matter of fact.
Why do you start with the science?
Well, because of exactly the reason that you're talking about. First of all, it's the social sciences in my case. That's my home stomping ground, Todd. You know, that's what I know how to do. That's what I'm trained in. That's what I'm comfortable doing. Table of numbers will make my heart beat fast. You know, that's what I like. Whereas my training in philosophy and theology is strictly amateur. You know, I don't have any professional training in that. So I'm very comfortable in that field of analyzing social science data and to an increasing extent, studies that have to do with medical outcomes and things like that. So statistics are statistics pretty much, you know, so you can transfer that kind of interpretive skill from one field to another and still pretty much know what you're talking about. So that's why.
Are your audiences and your opponents, if it's a debate situation, are they surprised when you trot out the science and you are able to demonstrate simply from the data that
all the assumptions
and claims may be wrong?
Oh, gosh, yes, they're always surprised. You know, that's just not what they expect. You know, I had a debate opponent come in one time, actually a very sophisticated guy, the guy who was the attorney for John Lawrence in the original Lawrence versus Texas case. I debated John Lawrence's attorney one time at the University of Houston, and he came all prepared with a whole sheet of things refuting Bible quotes, and he passed that out. Even though I went first and I spoke about structural harms to children and social science data and that kind of thing, didn't say a word about religion. And he stands up in his debate in his turn and starts passing out all this anti-Christian stuff. And I just said, when it was time for my rejoinder, I just said, you know, let the record show that the first person to bring up religion in today's debate was my opponent and not me. So, yeah, it's kind of fun. I'm kind of a mischievous person, and so that I enjoy seeing them squirm a little bit, you know, when I do something so unexpected as that.
It has been recently discovered that some of the studies that are oft-cited studies about homosexuality and its effects in people's lives have turned out to be bogus. Tell us about that.
Well, the most recent one is one that Mark Rigneris did. This is so funny. It's so ironic that it was him. That he's the one who undertook this. There was a study a couple of years ago where somebody purported to show that anti-gay stigma would reduce a person's life expectancy, reduced a gay person's life expectancy by 12 years. And so what Rigneris did was he went and got that data and tried to replicate that study. His original idea was he was going to test some alternative hypotheses, you know, but he couldn't replicate even the most basic result, much less than to go on to test other hypotheses. And he tried literally 10 different ways of redefining the data in order to get the result that this other scholar reported, and he could not replicate it. He could not replicate the man's results. And so, therefore, you know, that now that's been in print for, you know, a little while now. So far, that author has not replied in any way, and it leaves you to wonder, you know, where did this come from? You know, a few years ago, there was a study about which turned out to be completely faked, where a guy purported to show that if you went door to door canvassing and telling people about same-sex marriage, that people would be more likely to vote in favor of same-sex marriage. That study turned out to be completely fake. The guy never did the work. He claimed he got grants from foundations, and he never got those grants. You know, it was just one thing after another. And so the original story is played to great media fanfare, but then the retraction or the questions or the problems with the studies never get the same kind of attention. And so in a way, the damage has been done, even though the science is not there.
So it does. There's kind of a cautionary tale for folks like yourself is to simply say, when a study is cited, assume nothing, not even the validity of the study. Check it out yourself.
Well, that's exactly right. And as you know, I spend a lot of my time doing exactly that. I try to check the studies. If somebody calls me and says, let's talk about, you know, Dr. Morris's new study came out. Do you have any comment? Well, I always go look at the study before I comment, you know, because I certainly am not prepared as a rule to comment on somebody's press release, because I've just seen too many cases where the press release and the study told very different stories.
There was a recent CDC study about actually, yes. it was intended, I think, to compare teens who remained virgins with teens who didn't, sexually active teens. What it ended up revealing about bisexual and same-sex active teens in comparison, even to heterosexually active teens, much less virginal teens, was truly amazing. What was found there?
Well, this study, this was a CDC study, and it was quite interesting because they were looking at health disparities and health behaviors. So they looked at, you know, just kind of innocent things like seatbelt use. Have you ever been a passenger with a drinking driver, you know, with a classmate who was driving? Dating violence. Do you smoke? Have you ever done binge drinking? Those type of things, which are not directly related to sexuality. But what they were interested to know was, is one kind of sexually risky behavior related to these other kinds of risky behaviors, things that have negative consequences for your health? And so what they found is that if you compared the teens who were not sexually active at all, and then you compared them to sexually active teens who exclusively were sexually active with the opposite sex, and teens who were sexually active with either their own or both sexes, of course, the virginal kids had better results on every single measure, and the students who were involved with somebody of the same sex or who were bisexual, they did worse in every single measure. So it was quite astonishing. You know, you just wouldn't think that that would have any, that those things would be related. But I'll just read one: seatbelt use. Opposite sex active teens are 143% more likely to never or wear a seatbelt than their virginal peers. Same sex bisexually active teens are 317% more likely than virginal peers. Right. So there's something going on in the psyche of the kids who are sexually active that is leading them to take other kinds of risks, let's put it that way, and to engage in other kinds of behaviors that you might think are either reckless or you know, they're not properly regarding themselves, or they're not properly regarding the risks that they're taking, that kind of thing. It's striking, literally, Todd, every single one.
And without, I mean, it's difficult to do, but without making any kind of value judgments, just looking at that from a purely social science perspective, that's a red flag, isn't it?
Well, I would think it'd be a red flag. You know, in other words, if I were a perfectly rational teenager, which I realize is kind of an oxymoron, but, you know, let's suppose I were a very nerdy kind of teenager, and an adult came to me and said, listen, honey, you have a choice here of what you're going to do with yourself. You can be, I don't care if you're straight or gay, you should keep your fly zipped. You know, you should not be sexually active. And here's why. That hypothetical, hyper-rational teen would have to say, heck, I'm going to do something else. I'm not going to be sexually active, and I'm sure not going to be sexually active with somebody of the same sex, you know, because there are so many other risks associated with it. But I suspect, Todd, that that's not how it works. You know, I suspect that it's not the, you know, teens are sitting there thinking, well, gee, what shall I do with myself? I think it's that whatever it is that's in the psyche that's driving kids to be sexually active is also driving them to do other kinds of things. That would be my guess if you really got to the bottom of it. But that is important for people to understand, because then when you tell people, you know, having sex is a perfectly harmless activity, as long as you wear a condom, everything's okay. Well, no, actually, it could be that it's a big red flag for some kind of anxiety, some kind of low self-esteem. All kinds of things could be going on in the background of it besides, did this kid wear a condom, you know? And speaking of which, I think there's something in here about condom use. No, I thought that was, no, that was a different study. No, there's nothing in here about sexually unprotected sex. I'm not seeing that in here. Oh, sorry, changing the subject. but those studies are out there, you know, of how often do teens really and truly follow through and use the condom, which is the be-all and the end-all of sex ed, as you know.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest. This is part three of our series, our Social Progressives Anti-Science, on the subject today of homosexuality. When we come back, we're going to turn to another study and studies that show the dangers of homosexual behavior when it comes to sexually transmitted diseases, domestic violence, drug use, suicide rates, and yes, even the eventual lifespan. Stay tuned.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse of the Ruth Institute is our guest. It's part three of our series, Are Social Progressives Anti-Science? Today the subject is homosexuality. We do have a lot of data, don't we? And part of it has been accumulating since homosexuality was more mainstreamed. It has had that benefit of giving us better data on issues that are associated directly with homosexual behavior. And let's talk a little bit about, and these can be connected in either directly or indirectly to the behavior itself, beginning with sexually transmitted diseases.
Well, you know, Todd, I don't have these studies right at my fingertips, but it is a fact that whenever people ask the question, what kind of sexual behavior is more likely to lead to sexually transmitted diseases, men who have sex with men are always at the top of the list, you know, of people being disproportionately getting sexually transmitted diseases, new cases of sexually transmitted diseases, more likely to be used to be engaging in so-called unsafe sex, those kinds of things. The men having sex with men always lead the top of the chart. So I'm sorry I don't have anything real specific in front of me, but the fact is that is the CDC. You can look it up in the Centers for Disease Control, and you can find many studies that come to that conclusion.
But it certainly is part of it, but it may not be all the story. But I think often what we hear then is, well, you're really talking there about the 1980s, kind of the birth of gay pride in the United States when promiscuity, the pre-AIDS era, and then AIDS kind of quieted down and domesticated homosexuality. Is there any indication that the promiscuity that was so marked there before has in any way diminished even after the AIDS epidemic, so-called?
Well, it seemed like the behaviors were calming down a little bit. I mean, I think there's something to what you just said. But the fact is they have new medications that control the symptoms of AIDS, and that people can live a lot longer and more comfortably with the HIV virus. And so since that has started to happen, the behaviors have shifted pretty much back to where they were before. So you still see now a growth in the number of STDs that same-sex attracted men or men who have sex with men are displaying. And by the way, that MSM moniker, that is something that the medical community uses, and I want your listeners to understand how that's used. If you're a doctor or you're an epidemiologist and you're trying to study disease, you don't really care what people's self-perception is so much as you care about their behavior and their activity. And so they you will find they seldom use the term gay or homosexual in the professional papers and the studies themselves. Typically, they will say men who have sex with men because that's what they care about. If you're a person who is same-sex attracted and you're living a chaste life, they don't want you in the sample. You know, you don't count in this, towards understanding the progress of the disease, you see. And so whether you define yourself as gay, whether you identify as gay, whether you have sexual fantasies about the same sex and so on, that's not what they're interested in. They're just interested in the behavior. Are you having sex with a person of your same sex? And so that's why you'll see that terminology, MSM. It's not a euphemism. You know, I just want people to understand they're not trying to whitewash something. They're trying to be as clear as possible of whom they're asking the questions and about whom these data really apply.
I'm looking at an article from The Advocate, a famous gay newspaper now online, from a couple of years ago, talking about a national violence against women survey that was taken in Massachusetts. And it showed not just a marginal, but a large percentage of men and, surprisingly, women living in same-sex partner relationships who reported themselves physical violence in those relationships to the point of three times, in the case of men, three times that of heterosexuals, in the case of women, about another 50% higher than that of women. Does that surprise you?
Well, I've seen studies like that before, Todd. No, it doesn't surprise me. But I think people who are enthralled to the sexual revolutionary ideology and particularly the gender ideology, they will be surprised by those studies. They will be shocked by those studies because the theory that they have in their mind is that domestic violence and intimate partner violence, that is really just about male domination. And so I think an early fantasy was if you could just get the men away, the women would be perfectly fine and perfectly happy, and there would be no domestic violence. And likewise, if you've got two men together, there's not going to be any kind of attempt to dominate or anything like that because there won't be any women around, you know. And so according to that theory, you should see no domestic violence or less domestic violence in a same-sex relationship than in an opposite-sex relationship. And of course, as you just showed there, that turns out not to be the case at all. And in fact, I can't think of a study that goes against what you just said. There are numerous studies that come to a very similar result to what you just quoted.
We don't go into the specifics here, but there are also studies showing rates of mental illness, suicide, and then, of course, lifespan that seems to be associated in increasing numbers with same-sex behavior. What are your thoughts there?
Well, a lot of times those correlations are presented by the advocates of normalizing same-sex activity as evidence of social stigma. You know, if just straight people would be nicer, if society was more accepting, this wouldn't be happening. People wouldn't be so apt to commit suicide. People wouldn't be so apt to be depressed, and so on. So those studies, interestingly enough, that kind of study is very widely quoted within the gay community itself and by gay activists, but they want to use it to say that people are being too mean to them and that there's too much social stigma. If you could just get rid of social stigma, that would all go away. The problem with that is that when you have studies that attempt to control for that, compares situations of how much people get bullied or how much name calling they endure or whether you're living in the United States versus whether you're living in Holland or something like that, the fact is that measures of social stigma do account for some of the difference in mental health outcomes, but by no means do they account for all of it. So that suggests that there's something else at work behind that's giving rise to those numbers, because those numbers come up, they're quite consistent, Todd, that you see those disproportionate amounts of various kinds of mental health issues among people who are acting on their same-sex attraction.
I know that this study was really probably of great interest to you. It has to do with the University of Texas, a study about children of gay parents. What can you tell us about it?
Are you referring to my friend Mark Regnerus's study?
Yes.
From a few years ago, yes. Well, you know what? That study is extremely important, and it's a good study. And our listeners, you need to understand it is perfectly okay to quote that study. Matter of fact, we at the Ruth Institute have created a pamphlet called Children and Same-Sex Parenting, where we summarize the results of that study and several other studies that are showing negative results of associated with being raised in a same-sex couple household. And the thing that was striking about Mark Regnerus's study is his was the first one that really made a serious effort to get a random sample of the population to make sure that the people were representative of the gay community as a whole or of the population as a whole. The early studies that were done, Todd, about to show that lesbians make great parents and so on and so forth. Well, let me just read you from one of them of how they collected their data. This is from a study by Charlotte Patterson, who actually wrote the American Psychological Association's brief on how same-sex parenting is wonderful and has no problems. Listen to how she collected her data. See if you can see the problem with it. Recruitment began when I contacted friends, acquaintances, and colleagues who might be likely to know eligible lesbian mother families. Does anything jump out at you about that?
Sounds like she just kind of started scrolling through a Rolodex.
She called her friends, okay? So when she comes out with a study that says lesbians make great parents, what she's telling us is my friends at Berkeley are doing just fine. The children of my friends here at Berkeley, they're doing just fine. Does that generalize to the whole society? We have no idea. By contrast, what Dr. Regnerus did is, here's how he collected his data. The data collection was conducted by Knowledge Networks, a research firm with a very strong record of generating high-quality data for academic projects. It is a random, nationally representative sample of the American population. And that's the data that produced the results that show that, hey, there are some problems. There are some problems being reported by kids who are now adults. When they tell their own story and you've got a representative sample of them, you do find that there are problems with kids whose parents have had a same-sex relationship.
So to bring this all together, Jen, do social conservatives need to fear that the science is not on their side when they are making the case against homosexuality and same-sex marriage?
No, you really don't need to be afraid about the science. You know, we haven't even mentioned this big study that came out from the Atlantis that went through and dissected gender identity, transgenderism, a lot of those other topics, and found that the scientific claims simply are not where they should be if you're going to be making these sweeping demands of society the way the activists have been doing. So no, social conservatives, on the contrary, need to get more involved in science, need to follow the science, need to trust that the natural law is good and true and produces good results. That's what I think all this shows, Todd, that when you look at nature and you look at the science, what you find is that God's plan for humanity actually works out better than all the alternatives that we've been able to cook up on our own. And I find that that increases my faith, doesn't decrease it one bit.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. And she's author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. You'll find a link to this book and to the Ruth Institute right there at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Jennifer, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
Terry Mattingly will join us on the other side of the break. A startling admission, although if you stop and think about it, not that surprising given where it came from. The executive editor of the New York Times said, he actually did say, and I quote, "We don't get religion." Now, what was the context of that statement? What was he saying as a part of a larger audience? We'll deal with that with Terry Mattingly on the other side of this break.
We we know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as Confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the clcc.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a Confessional Lutheran. The clcc.org.
Please help us finish in the black financially for the 9th consecutive year by making a year-end tax-deductible gift. With 3 weeks left, we're $54,000 short of expenses. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of Issues Etc. at the end of 2016.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211. 452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Issues Etc. book of the month for December is a Christmas book for children ages 5 through 9. It's titled The Christmas Connection. You can find out more about this new Christmas arch book at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase The Christmas Connection by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Your young children, grandchildren, and godchildren will discover the relationship between Jesus' birth and resurrection in The Christmas Connection. 1-800-325-3040.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.